Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, my friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show there was Song of the Siren by Morgan Baum, and you can find more of her wonderful music at her website, sacredhands.org. But let's turn our attention immediately to tonight's show. As many of you know, adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, disrespected. That's why here on the show I'm dedicated to recovering the great she, whether we look at her as deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so we might know why things are the way they are, how they have come to be turned on their head and so unnatural, and we're going to go about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, I think we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, if we want partnership, it is women armed with the ideas of the sacred feminine alongside the divine masculine who will set things back on course. And both of our guests tonight, well, they do that in their own way. At the top of the hour is the ordained woman priest, Jane Villa. And yes, I will ask her why she does not call herself priestess. Jane is one of those uppity women claiming her spiritual authority and leadership, and good for her. She defied the Roman Catholic Church, who puts ordaining women on par with pedophilia. We're going to talk about the theological evidence for ordination of women, why the sacred feminine matters. We'll get into her personal story and why this is far bigger than just about ordaining women. We'll probably answer what many of you have no doubt asked yourself, why even stick around the Roman Catholic Church? Then in the latter part of the show, Vajrama, a sister of mine who was once a mentor many years ago. Well, Vajra has just written her book, From a Hidden Stream, The Natural Spiritual Authority of Woman, and we're going to get into it. What is this natural spiritual authority? Why does it matter? How does it relate to the woman's body? The indicators and evidence that women's spiritual authority is historical, examples of women asserting their natural spiritual authority today, and how this restoration can bring us sanity and peace. So, wow. Well, wonderful bookends. Is this going to be a dynamic duo I have lined up for you tonight or what? For the last couple weeks I've been saying this, so let me repeat it once again. It feels appropriate. Let me read to you what have become the mottos for the show. Number one. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. That's from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. And the second, attributed to Gandhi, I think, goes like this. First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win. So as some of us say, Ashi, Amen, Alleluia, Jai Ma. But just a few more quick things, some housekeeping before we get to our guest tonight. Under new developments, I have a wonderful new article I'd love for you to read on my Examiner column called Jesus as a Goddess Advocate. There's been good feedback, so please go there, post your comment. You can find my column by going to laexaminer.com. Putting my name in the search, or even easier, go to my website, KarenTate.com, and on the homepage, there's a link to my column. It's also on Facebook. Blog Talk is no longer free to hosts like myself. They have just started this year to start to charge us. So now it's going to cost us a minimum every month to continue to have the show. It's not a lot of money yet, but I'm hoping if you like Voices of the Sacred Feminine, you'll help support us. Remember, like nature teaches us, what you tend, what you nurture, what you nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations. So here I am again, sounding like a PBS spokesperson on a fundraising drive. Please support us to help keep us on the air. If you'd like to make a donation, go to the Goddess Store page of my website at KarenTate.com. There are PayPal buttons there. Make a donation of any amount you can afford. And please remember the three F's. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite, be sure to become our friend, and click follow so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week. That way you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And please remember and tell your friends that I'll be leading a sacred tour to Turkey, Anatolia as it was once called, Land of the Nourishing Mothers, next November. This is a trip for men and women. We'll be going to places like Istanbul, Ephesus, Çatalhöyük, Side, Lagina. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations, rituals on the sites, Turkish baths, even doing mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite's temples outside Aphrodisias. So if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey to satisfy your mind, your body, or your soul, check out the website. We have really gotten a good, good price. And people are signing up already, so if you want to make sure to, you know, lock in your space, start thinking about sending in a deposit now. And while you're at KarenTate.com, check out my two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. While you're there, look for the free stuff. We all like free stuff. Besides the wonderful information that teaches and the articles and essays there, there are free meditations. And I have one for spring that is all about the pagan dying and rising god sitting at the knee of goddess. And in the end of the meditation, those faces morph from one god to another and end with the face of Jesus, referencing the pagan roots of Christianity and how we might find common ground with our progressive Christian friends. And don't forget, finally, if you're listening live and you want to call in to talk to my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know a lot of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see your number on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation and invite you to give your comment or question. So let's not delay any further. We have a lot to talk about tonight. I want to thank Jane Via for her patience during my intro, and I want to tell listeners a little bit about her, and then we'll start our chat. First of all, she is a full-time deputy DA in San Diego. She's married. She has two children. Her background is a BA from Purdue University, where she studied Spanish, also the University of Madrid in Spain. She has a PhD from Marquette University in Religious Studies and a JD from the University of San Diego School of Law. She was a lecturer and assistant professor of religion at Mercy College of Detroit, an assistant and associate professor of religious studies at the University of San Diego. Lots of other stuff. She lectured widely in Southern California in Roman Catholic parishes, synagogues, and Protestant churches. She was ordained a Roman Catholic deacon in 2006 on the Danube River. She founded the Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community, an independent Roman Catholic parish with Roman Catholic priest Rod Stevens in 2005. She was ordained a Roman Catholic priest in 2006 on the Bodonese, Bodensee. She's a member of the Roman Catholic Woman Priest Movement. She's the pastor of Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community in San Diego, California. She was placed under interdict by Robert Brom, Roman Catholic Bishop of San Diego, California, in 2006, present for perceived violations of Canons 1028 and 1378, and she was finally excommunicated latae sententia by general decree of the Vatican in May 2009. I apologize, Jane, for murdering those Latin words. I was pretty close, maybe.
Yes, you were. Close enough. We understand what you're saying.
So what does that mean exactly, though, for the layperson placed under interdict? Is that when you got, like, your warning or something that you were on shaky ground?
Well, it was an initial legal response to the publicity surrounding my ordination. Until my ordination was publicized, I really had no interaction with the local bishop regarding my ordination. But once it became a public phenomenon, then the bishop was, by his own position, forced to take some action towards me. And the action he took at the time was that of placing me under interdict. Interdict is similar to excommunication, but it's a lesser penalty. It does prevent a person from receiving any of the seven sacraments in the Roman Catholic Church.
Okay. And just for listeners who this may be the first time they are hearing of Roman Catholic women priests, let's, you know, just for their benefit, start at the beginning and please tell us who that is. What is that group? What is their mission?
Well, it began in 2002 with a group of seven women who were ordained on the Danube River in Europe, and they were multinational. Some were German, some were Austrian. There was one United States citizen, although she was Austrian by heritage. She had been born and grown up in Austria. That movement was generated in a European context by a group of women who had really worked hard for women's ordination for years and finally received information from a sympathetic cardinal that nothing was going to change in the Roman Catholic Church and that if women were going to be ordained, they were going to have to do it themselves. So they did. And then that group was publicized. I learned of it not when they were ordained, but later when they were excommunicated. The fact of their ordination didn't make the news in San Diego. It was only the fact of their excommunication. So it took me about a year and a half to find out who they were, where they were, how I could reach them, how I could contact them. But once I was able to track them down, I contacted them and asked them if there was any chance for a woman from the United States to participate in the movement, and that's how I got involved. My experience with the European group of women was that they're very well educated. They are fairly visionary and progressive in their theology. So my personal orientation towards this movement was, I think, profoundly shaped by my experience of these European women who I met, first of all, in 2004 when I was ordained a deacon, and then again in 2006 when I was ordained a priest. I'm not sure that the United States movement necessarily reflects all of the same interests, concerns, directions, attitudes of those European women in the time that I was exposed to them. So I would think I would have to say at this point, the goal of the Roman Catholic Woman Priest movement may depend somewhat on to whom you speak in the movement. But in general, the goal of the movement is to promote the ordination of women and to make the ordination of women in the Roman Catholic Church possible. So there are women who are already ordained who are dedicated to trying to prepare women who are not yet ordained but would like to be in order to become adequately prepared to function as Roman Catholic priests in the modern world. And that's the primary goal, I believe, of the movement.
Now, was there a reason it was done over water?
There was. particularly as the movement began in Europe, but also in the United States when it first migrated here. The diocese of a particular bishop is a geographical area over which that bishop, and of course it's always a he at this point in time, has legal jurisdiction and legal responsibility. So had a group of women been ordained in a particular geographical location on the land, then that bishop would have stood to suffer potential reprisals. In Europe, countries are so close together that they are often separated by waterways. So one way to step out of any national jurisdiction and simultaneously out of any particular Roman Catholic juridical geographical area was to become to have the ordinations on waterways. So initially, for a few years, the ordinations were always on water in international waters so that no particular bishop would be held accountable for what we were doing.
Okay. And I got to get it out of the way. Why use a male term for your title? Why not just take it all the way and say Roman Catholic priestess?
I suppose we could say Roman Catholic priestess, but and I'm not sure I can speak for the entire movement in this regard either. I'm speculating to some extent, but I think that because the movement is designed to reform an existing institution, that to some extent we retain the language of the institution we're trying to reform. In other words, if one uses language that is perceived not so much by the institutional leaders but by the faithful believers around the world as outrageous and language that they can't understand and have no connection with, then the movement might have less success than if it uses language with which the not only the hierarchy but the faithful Catholics and believers around the world are familiar and comfortable. So
okay.
By saying priest, what we convey to them is we are the same thing as those men in your local parishes who are conducting your services.
Right.
We do the same things they do.
Right, right. Well, maybe we can progress to that down the road.
Perhaps.
You know, because if you're reforming, you know, if, you know, as I read in that, that Time article, and again, I don't know whether this speaks for all of you women priests or if it was just the person that was being quoted, but some of, in your liturgy there in San Diego, do you also use gender neutral or God, Mother, and Father, you know, in you know, when you're having Mass?
I think actually we are probably the leaders in that aspect of the Roman Catholic women priest movement in the world. Yes, we use only inclusive language for the sacred and for obviously for humanity as well. So while if we ever say Father, we also say Mother in the immediate proximity of the use of the word Father. We focus on theology that is more progressive, theology that takes into account the new cosmology, and so we often use phrases for the sacred, such as holy mystery, creative being, holy one. Our language is less genderized than I think you'll find it is in some Roman Catholic women priest communities.
Okay. All right. Now, as far as ordination of women in the Roman Catholic Church, I understand there's an official and an unofficial basis for them opposing it. Can you explain both?
Yes. I'm not sure every theologian would agree with me that that is the case, but I perceive it that way, that there are two levels. The official level is the level at which the Vatican speaks. The Vatican makes pronouncements, the Vatican makes promulgations, and they take theological and juridical stands on particular issues such as women's ordination. And as we all know, their stand is that women's ordination cannot be justified in the Roman Catholic Church, and this particular position of the Church can never be changed. But I think there's another level to the whole phenomenon, and that is the level of unconscious sexism that is very profound, because the second millennium of church history, which was the millennium in which women were finally completely rooted out of leadership positions in the church, but for abbesses in monasteries which were populated by women only, until that, once that had happened, the theology that develops to justify the complete eradication of women from leadership positions is highly misogynistic. Gary Macy, in his book, The Hidden History of Women's Ordination in the West, includes multiple footnotes in that book, which no one has to read. You can just read the essay if you want without ever reading the footnotes. But in many of the footnotes, he translates the ancient Latin into contemporary English. And one sees the really awful things that are said about women in by the church in the Middle Ages. So I think those that mentality is still very real. It may be unconscious. It may be conscious and simply considered completely acceptable to be misogynist. But I think that it's a very important aspect of the position of the Roman Catholic hierarchy, the magisterium, towards women's ordination.
But Jane, now I'm a former Catholic. I mean, I was born a Catholic. I consider myself a recovering Catholic now. I guess what I want to know is, how do they justify the misogyny? Misogyny is an ugly thing. How can they not consider that a sin? Does it go back to how they perceive Eve, that she was the cause of it all?
It might. I'm unsure myself what caused the emergence of a really virulent misogynism in the 11th and 12th centuries of church history. And I'm not sure anybody knows what the origin of that was. It may have just been a power tool. It may have been the importance of monastic life in the church, where men lived alone in monasteries and therefore had very little contact with women, very little appreciation for women, very little understanding of women, and of course considered women a threat to their lifestyle, because if they were too close to women, it was problematic. So they justify it based on their interpretation of scripture and tradition and church law.
And forgive me for saying this, but I'm just candid and upfront. You know, from somebody like myself who studied feminist theology, I can't help but think there's, you know, at least a little iota of vagina envy. You know, and by that I mean the ability to give life. You know, if what some of us think could have been the history, that when goddess was revered for maybe 30,000 years by association, women were elevated as life givers, you know, the idea of the sacred blood, women could bleed without dying, blah blah blah, that was a powerful role. You know, maybe they just got tired of being second class, if they were. I mean, I don't know, and I'm not saying, I'm expecting you to have an answer. I'm just, you know, sort of, you know, making a comment. But, you know, maybe it was just, maybe for some it was as simple as that.
It may have been, and it certainly is implicit in the shift from a goddess tradition in which there was a singular goddess expressed in many different forms, but essentially almost a monotheistic goddess who was worshipped throughout the world, to a polytheistic sort of framework for religious experience, to ultimately a religious experience that imagines a monotheistic deity, but in a male form only, described in male language, whose power is always carried out through male beings, and so on. So it certainly suggests a shift in not just culture, but power.
Yeah, and I mean, it's almost as if in this shift, I mean, everything that was, you know, that gave women their prominence, you know, their life-giving ability, their sacred blood, all of that became, you know, dirty and taboo and stuff you didn't talk about. You know, not just the gender. I mean, the whole, you know, the whole procreation idea, you know, associated with women. I mean, even that, it seems like anything about woman was suddenly, you know, diminished and denigrated and, well, sadly, of course. And it's turning what's natural on its head, it seems, you know. You said that there's, I believe that, you know, one of the other reasons, at least I read in this article, one of the other people who was interviewed, one of the other woman priests said that the church can justify not having women be ordained because they claim that none of Jesus' apostles were female. So obviously they're not, you know, thinking in terms of how many of us do today, that Mary Magdalene was maybe the ultimate apostle. But is that pretty typical too?
That's pretty typical. I think that's what most Roman Catholic clergy believe. Jesus didn't call women apostles. He only called men to be apostles. Therefore, and the apostles were the forerunners of priests, therefore women can never be priests because women could never be apostles. And yes, it ignores the role of Mary Magdalene as the apostle of the resurrection, the apostle to the apostles.
Well, and I'm thinking too, and forgive me, I can't quote the scriptures specifically, and, you know, I didn't do that much homework. But, I mean, I know, you know, I've heard goddess scholars or feminist scholars give talks, and, you know, so much of the Bible relies on translations. And, you know, and my memory is from hearing some of these talks that oftentimes, you know, the word, you know, kingdom actually was changed from, you know, maybe it was the Greek, which was actually queendom, or the pronouns were changed from she to he. So, you know, you have to wonder if this wasn't just a mistake, but actually deliberate, you know, and that makes it, I think, a little bit more insidious and circumspect.
You know, deliberate, and I think they tried to justify it with theology, but I do believe it was deliberate.
Now, there's scriptural and historical evidence for ordination of women. Let's get into that a little bit, you know, and explain that to us.
I think most contemporary scripture scholars would agree that Jesus didn't ordain anybody. So there's no evidence really in the New Testament literature and the gospel traditions that Jesus ordained men, nor is there information that Jesus ordained women. The passage which is always used as the purported justification or appointment of Jesus, the ordaining of Jesus of the apostles, is the Last Supper. And of course, it's a very stylized picture that doesn't reflect, I think, the likely historical picture of the Judaism of Jesus' time. It's a gathering. The picture that they use is that there was a gathering of men around a table, and it was just the apostles who were there. And Jesus talked to them, and Jesus said to them, "Do this in memory of me." And since there came a point in time when only male priests could say the words, "Do this in memory of me," the thinking, which is anachronistic, if you will, is that Jesus said that only men could be ordained priests. But that's really imposing language and religious practice of later generations on, certainly on Scripture and probably on the first several centuries of the church as well. So there's really no evidence that Jesus ordained anyone from a scriptural perspective. Secondly, there's lots and lots of evidence that Jesus shared his life, his ministry, his work with women, and that women supported him in many ways, including financially. And thirdly, if you look at those lists of apostles which appear in the synoptic tradition, while the names of some of the apostles, arguably most, are stable as you move from Matthew to Mark to Luke, there are also different names in the list of apostles. So the concept that there is a clear picture of who the 12 were in Jesus' life and time is subject to, I think, serious questioning. And then lastly, of course, there's Paul, who never met the historical Jesus but called himself an apostle and considered himself an apostle because he took on the work of the mission, just as Mary Magdalene became the apostle of the resurrection, even though she was not noticeably, it's not included in our current biblical tradition that Mary Magdalene was sent on a mission by Jesus to preach the gospel during his lifetime. That doesn't appear in the gospel tradition, but of course we don't know how much was eliminated by the people who told the story,
mm-hmm.
And chose to eliminate aspects of the story that they found uncomfortable or unpleasing. Then the final evidence is, I think, in Paul, where we see that women were deaconing, women were leading in many very important ways in the early ministry of Paul, and that he acknowledged that, he respected the women with whom he worked, he valued the women with whom he worked. And then finally, the more recent archaeological evidence that there are women, there are tombs, there are graves, there are catacomb paintings that indicate there were women deacons, there were women priests, there were some women bishops, that women celebrated the Eucharist, that and all of this went on more frequently in the first two or three centuries, but ultimately up until about the 10th century when finally this dramatic cultural shift, cultural and theological shift occurred in a relatively short period of about 50 years, in which women were virtually and completely eliminated from any leadership positions.
Well, how did that happen? Who brought that on or why?
Well, I wish I could explain it to you briefly. I'm not an historical theologian, but this is the subject of Gary Macy's book, The Hidden History of Women's Ordination in the West, and I really encourage people who who want the answer, the full answer, to read the book. But it happened among the male leaders who took over and endorsed a misogynistic worldview and a juridical approach to Christianity, the birth of canon law, and so on.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the sacred feminine. Obviously, you said your church down there in San Diego was, sort of trailblazing the idea of incorporating, both genders. From your perspective as a Roman Catholic woman priest, why does the sacred feminine matter? And we'll answer that first.
The sacred feminine matters because people in our culture can't think about the sacred without imagining the sacred in gender terms. And, of course, most people only imagine the sacred as masculine. And I have to say I'm amazed that even people who've been members of our community for 5 years who never worship in exclusive language will occasionally stand up at the Prayer of the Faithful and speak about the Lord or God He as if, we haven't been developing multiple diverse images for the sacred that are not specifically masculine gender. Those masculine concepts are really brutal on the development of the feminine psyche. I remember being years and years ago in a women's group in which the question was raised, what do you think about, how do you feel when you read the story about God creating Adam and Eve? And a little girl who was in the group, she was the last to speak, but she was invited to give her reception, and she said, I feel guilty for being a girl.
Yeah.
I mean, she just captured so simply what happens to the female psyche when we're born into a world in which all religions are patriarchal, but women often have spontaneous spiritual qualities and religious experience that needs to be nested somewhere, but were nested in religions in which only men lead, all the language about God is male, all of the rituals are conducted by men. Women have really no place, and as it's often said in the Roman Catholic Woman Priest movement, women have access to 6 sacraments, but not 7. Women have absolutely zero access to significant leadership positions anywhere in the Roman Catholic Church. We don't get to contribute to doctrine, dogma, canon law, how ritual will be conducted, the words of the Eucharist, none of those things. So it's unconscious, but it's a profoundly pervasive negation of women as women.
Well, and I mean, it goes without saying, it demoralizes women. It puts, you know, it's programming them to tolerate oppression everywhere. I mean, heavens, if you have to tolerate oppression in my church by my God, by the leaders of, you know, people who emulate God, then, I think that sort of translates, you know, maybe you let your husband beat you or, all the other ways that, you know, women are subjugated in our society. It's almost like they set the female psyche up for that.
Yes. I totally agree.
So, tell me some of the ways that in your congregation, you incorporate the sacred feminine. Do you have female imagery on the altar, or how is it you make this transition?
Well, I think one of the most important things we do is that we always use radically and completely inclusive language in not only in our liturgy but in our song, in the music, in the songs we sing. So even to the extent of altering Christmas carols as needed, some people find very difficult because we all have emotional connections to Christmas carols, but we change all of the words to be gender inclusive. Then we have developed what we consider to be progressive Catholic theological approaches to the Eucharist. So, for instance, the Eucharistic prayer, which consists of several paragraphs in the canonical church, is always said in the canonical church by the priest who is male. In our congregation, the opening paragraph is read by the priest. The paragraph just before the consecration is read by the priest. The words of consecration are read by everyone, or said by everyone, and then the priest usually closes. So the priest sort of has a role of bookends, you know, leading in the liturgy, but all of the other paragraphs are read by people in the community, and those people change every week. They are men and women, and there are people who are stopped on their way in and asked, would you like to read paragraph 3 of the Eucharistic prayer today? And so the voices pop up from around the community. One never knows from where they will come. Sometimes they are 3 or 4 feminine voices in a row. It's just the way it happens. Sometimes there are a couple male voices in a row and then a female voice. But I think that both the participation by women in those in the reading of those texts, which have always been considered so sacred, are very important to what we do. We're also committed to democracy within the church, so the priest does not run everything. We have committees that really make decisions about how we conduct the life of the community, and women are very important in leadership in those committees and have very concrete deciding roles. We have a nonprofit board. The chair is a woman and has been since inception. We have a parish council. The current chair of the parish council is a woman. In fact, I think every chair has been a woman except for the very first chair who was a man, a gay man. So women are very pervasively involved in the actual creation and life of this community, as well as in the language and style of our worship. Then in our worship, we do something that's very important, I think, and that is we not only translate the words of the Greek or Hebrew readings into inclusive English language, but we have gone back through the entire biblical tradition, the Bible, and looked for every significant reading about a woman in the Bible. And we have incorporated those readings into our lectionary, whether we're talking about Hebrew Bible or Jesus Scriptures. So we follow the Roman Catholic lectionary along until there's a reading about a woman that is skipped in the Roman Catholic lectionary. And when that happens, we incorporate that reading about a woman, and then we have found readings in the broader New Testament writings and in the Hebrew Bible and in the Psalm tradition to accompany those readings. So women are very much a part of the scripture readings that occur in our community. And then, of course, we have women presiding and women preaching, and when women preach on those passages that involve women, we try to bring in a lot of history, culture, background, as well as interpretation of the passages. So those are some of the things that we do.
So let me ask you then, and that all sounds awesome, but as you are incorporating mother alongside father, goddess alongside God, does that sort of almost force you to look at deity differently? You know, does deity somehow then change?
I hope so. I hope that it's changing the concept of deity in the minds of those who worship with us. I hope that it enables them to, or frees them to, imagine deity in a feminine form or in a masculine form. But I also hope that we are challenging them to go beyond the anthropomorphization mm-hmm. of God, to use images that really transcend imagining God in human ways and in human forms, which, you know, are very typical of ancient religious experience, but not necessarily warranted in light of contemporary historical experience.
Okay, all right. There's someone that's been patiently waiting on the switchboard here. Let me see if they have a question. They might possibly just be listening. But caller from the 818 area code, I'm going to unmute you to see if you have a question.
Hi, Karen. It's Dharma.
Hi. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you. I'm myself Catholic by tradition, Mexican Catholic, and there was a little booklet circulated kind of in a convent that I was attending, kind of on the sly, which talked about Adam's first wife. I believe her name was Fika or something similar, and I was wondering if this new setting with women priests, is that something that is taken up, and what do they, you know, is it genuine? Is it taken up? That's my question. Thank you.
The story about Adam having wives other than Eve comes from traditions that are not biblical. It doesn't mean they're not important traditions. They're just not biblical traditions. And so we haven't actually read a story about Lilith or a story about other women associated with Adam. I don't think we'd be opposed to that. We often incorporate readings that are not scriptural. Periodically, we use non-scriptural readings in the course of our liturgy, and that's been a request of our community members. But that particular request hasn't been made yet. The forum in which I learned about those things was really with Jewish feminists in San Diego County, for whom those characters have a lot more meaning, because I believe there are ancient Jewish texts that we as Christians don't use, which incorporate stories about those women.
Okay. Now, Jane, what I always hear is, why even why even want to be a part of a church that just reeks of such misogyny? Why try to change it from within? I mean, I assume you're probably not getting a dime of support. why not just start your own thing?
Well, I think there are probably some members of Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic community who would be completely fine with that. They don't care about Rome. They're not interested in Rome. But the majority of us still believe that there is some value in attempting to change the Roman Catholic Church. And for me, it starts with a concrete reality that there is no religion extant in the contemporary world anywhere that is not patriarchal. So take your pick. I, for many years, participated in a women's group that was very important and very instrumental in my development, and both intellectual, theological, and also spiritual, that focused on women's spiritual experience alone and goddess traditions. But interestingly, what happened with me was I had two boys, and I learned very quickly my sons were not welcome there. I did experience the reverse of misogynism. There are women who really don't have any value for men. My husband's my best friend. I was concerned that my children, my boys, grow up in a religious context. I wanted them to experience a faith. I wanted them to experience religious community. And they were not welcome in that community. So for me, it became... I looked for a place where I could be a family.
Right.
And in many ways, Roman Catholic parishes are wonderful places to be families.
Right.
It's just hard on you if you're a woman who's conscious. You know, it's very painful to be a woman in a Roman Catholic parish. So that's why my goal became changing the Roman Catholic Church, using its structure, using its model, but changing its theology, changing the way it understands itself in order to incorporate full gender equality, as well as other types of equality, radical inclusivity, which I believe really was at the core of Jesus' teaching mission. So for me, it's important to change that church because I know that there are families out there all over the place who feel like I felt then. They want a place where they can go to worship as a family. So that's one factor, and I'm sorry, did you want to?
No. My mind is going in lots of different directions. I have so many questions for you, but I wanted to say I totally understand what you're saying about the goddess community. I've experienced that myself. You know, I've been married to a wonderful man for 25 years, and in fact, I'm getting ready to give a paper at a pagan conference, which is, you know, scholars and practitioners. And one of the things in our building community theme I'm going to say is, if we seriously want to build goddess communities or pagan communities, that's one thing to look at, because a woman can't fully commit to a community that doesn't allow her to include her sons or her husband. You know, and really we're just perpetuating the same sort of sexism that's been perpetuated against us. When you make these changes, though, Jane, and I'm not against making the changes, but doesn't it really sort of change the church at the core? Is it really the same church then?
I think it is, because one of the wonderful things about the Roman Catholic tradition is that it is so old, it really can be traced back pretty much to the first century, to the time of Jesus in the first century, and the first efforts to make church, the first efforts to create church in the Roman Catholic tradition, which were, by and large, house churches involving primarily families who came together to be in community and build an experience of God around their understanding of who Jesus was. And I think that that's very much what we do at Mary Magdalene Apostle Catholic Community. But and we structure our liturgy, even though the words are different, we structure it exactly like. The skeleton of our liturgy is the same skeleton as the canonical Roman Catholic liturgy. So people who come experience it as different, but they also experience it as the same.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to say, if I might, is that it goes beyond my personal experience, however, and that is the Roman Catholic Church is this enormous institution that is situated in cultures and societies worldwide. And the misogynism of the church, the discrimination against women that is embodied in the church and therefore considered sacred, spills over into the societies of which it is a part. And so it becomes the basis for the oppression of women all over the world. So it's really important for women to call this institution to accountability and to attempt to change it to the kind of inclusive community that I think Jesus intended. And by doing that, I think we help women and children, because whenever women are discriminated against, children also suffer, to help women worldwide develop a new self-respect, self-esteem, self-understanding, leadership qualities, and leadership roles. So I consider it very important to stay connected to this institution, which very often is tragically disappointing at best.
Well, and I'm hearing you, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, something as wicked as pedophilia, they can't even deal with. I mean, it's almost as if the church has just really become so out of touch, so irrelevant. I mean, it's almost as if, and please, I'm not trying to be offensive. You know, I'm just, you know, making observations. I mean, I was a Catholic too. It's almost as if, you know, they're like untouchable. You know, I mean, it's like they won't even admit their own sin. You know, the sin of misogyny, the pedophilia stuff. Do you not think that by supporting the church, let me rephrase it. If you know, people who were opposed to the pedophilia, opposed to the misogyny, if they stopped supporting the church, wouldn't that force them to really look at what they're doing and change, rather than just allowing the status quo to, you know, keep moving forward, you know?
I think it's critical that Roman Catholics quit giving money to the institution. If they want to use their own money to keep their own parish running on their own terms, I think that's fine. But I think in terms of giving money that goes to the diocese, that goes to Rome, it's very important that Roman Catholics protest by not giving. On the other hand, I am a Vatican II Catholic. I don't believe that the hierarchy or the magisterium is the church. They happen to control most of the power, but I don't believe that they are the church. The people, the faithful people, those who choose to be connected to God through the Roman Catholic tradition, are the church. And so I don't equate their horrible deeds, and they're horrific. I was a prosecutor for many years who prosecuted child sex abuse cases, and it just is appalling that most members of the Roman Catholic hierarchy take the attitude that they do regarding the terrible victimization of children, and I might add, of women in the Roman Catholic Church. But I don't want to confuse them with the church. They think they're the church. They think that the rest of us are just there to serve them and God. But Vatican II said otherwise, and I think Vatican II is much more in tune with the teaching of Jesus in the gospel traditions of the New Testament. And we are church. We are all church. They are just one small part of what church is.
That's refreshing. I'm glad to hear you say that. Well, the other I got an email in. Someone wanted me, you know, to ask you here. Do you think do you have support, a quiet support within the hierarchy of the church? And do you ever think we will see a day where at the front of a Roman Catholic church we will see an image of Goddess standing next to an image of, say, Jesus?
Well, we already have that in the Roman Catholic Church because the Virgin Mary was in many ways an adaptation in the Roman Catholic Church of the goddess tradition. You know, we just celebrated the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and Our Lady of Guadalupe was literally a replacement for an Aztec goddess, and she appeared on a hill where there had been a temple of an Aztec goddess, and she asked the person to whom she appeared to build her a temple, not a church, and she was responsible for the very, very rapid conversion, essentially, of Central and ultimately South America. So many goddess qualities have already been attributed to Mary, and in fact, even the institutional church came very close to declaring her the fourth member of the Trinity in the 19th century. So, we already in many ways have that. It's the way she appears in the statue. It's the concept of women that is depicted in her look. And yes, already I am seeing statues of Mary in contemporary churches which look nothing like the pious, obedient, humble Mary who puts her eyes down and keeps her hands folded and who looks oppressed.
Right.
So
right,
I think clearly those things will happen. I think Christians kind of embrace the Jewish theology that you really can't make a concrete picture of God, or a statue of God. To some extent, I'm sure many Jews would be quick to point out, well, what about the Sistine Chapel? And what about, so there have been artistic efforts in the history of Christianity to capture visually what God might look like, and it's in a male form. But I think in general, Christians think that Jesus is the person through whom we see God. And as we change our concept of Jesus, shifting the emphasis away from Jesus being God's son in a literal, biological way, and therefore divine in some way that other humans are not, as we shift our theology of Jesus to focus on his humanity and the capacity of divinity to express itself in human form, and as we shift our images of Mary, I think we will see new depictions of both, and there will be significant balance in the way they appear in Catholic churches.
Okay. And another question that I have for you, and at least it feels like to me, this would be a way for whether we're talking Roman Catholics or just Christians in general, I think to be more relevant, I wonder why we don't hear, unless it's just our media, why we don't hear more, priests coming out and talking about social justice, talking against greed, talking about what's happening out there in the world, to be more like Jesus. It just seems like there's so much hypocrisy, and there's not loud enough leadership in the churches, about morality. And I don't know, I think you know what I'm saying.
Yes. Well, the church is a monarchy, and the power goes down just as it would in any feudal society, or as it did from the Roman emperor to the lords who served him, to the people who served the lords, etc. And in that power structure, reprisals are swift, concrete, and severe. So it's virtually impossible for a Roman Catholic priest to openly speak out, for instance, about women's ordination without being excommunicated, losing his job, losing his retirement, losing the ministry he may even love and be good at. Because there are some priests functioning in the Roman Catholic Church who are gifted spiritual leaders and gifted pastors. So it's very, very difficult. Why they don't speak out more on financial evils may have to do with the marriage of the Roman Catholic Church to the religious right in the United States in the 80s and 90s, and particularly during the Bush administration. That, but that was done by the hierarchy. But the hierarchy dictates in a very concrete way that touches every single priest worldwide what really they're able to say and not say. Catholics have, by and large, been brainwashed for centuries and taught that we can't think other than what the official church teaches.
Right, yeah, they basically just want to herd a sheeple, that, you know, increased offertory giving. So now your church, Jane, I'm making a big assumption here. I think that Roman Catholic churches on the corner that are going by the rules, they must get some money from the church. And if you're excommunicated, you certainly aren't. How does your church support itself?
That is an important issue, because if we're going to sustain our existence into the future, we have to figure out that problem. Right now, we have a budget of about $100,000 a year, and all of that money comes from people who attend our small congregation of about 150 people. We've had one gift of $10,000 since inception 5 years ago. So we struggle, and part of the reason we've been able to survive is because I am a worker priest. I work during the day. I support myself by working as a deputy district attorney. My health insurance comes from my paid job, and I'm able to support my family without any financial assistance from this parish. We pay Rod Stevens to come from Irvine so many hours a month to work as a pastoral associate. And we also pay Nancy Corin, who was ordained independently of a bishop, I might add, in our community, called by our community, ordained in our community, for our community, to serve our community, and we pay her. We're not paying her a fully just wage yet, but we're getting there. We don't pay her a terrible wage either. We pay her about $27 an hour, I believe. So it could be worse. But obviously, in order to survive into the future, we're going to have to learn either to give more ourselves, as most Protestants do. You know, Catholics are very used to relying on the diocese for assistance, and the diocese often provides assistance to a parish that doesn't have adequate funding on its own. So either we're going to have to learn to give more than we're accustomed to giving, or we're going to have to grow enough that we have enough people giving that even at that lower rate we can sustain ourselves, or we're going to have to seek and hopefully someday receive a large donation that will enable us to have a fund from which we can move into the future.
Okay. And now we're going to have to come to a close here. And so I guess I want to make my final question a two-pronged question. Why is this more than just about not discriminating against the female gender? And is there anything you would like to tell listeners that you feel is important that, I have not managed to ask you tonight?
Well, earlier when we were talking, Karen, one of the things that went through my head was I'm really not interested in changing from one form of discrimination to another.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in replacing sexism against women for sexism against men.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it's because I'm an attorney. Perhaps it's because I'm focused in my life to trying to do justice in the context of a criminal justice system, because I appreciate the value of the Constitution of the United States. I don't know. Perhaps it's those things. But for me, it's not just about changing one form of sexism for another. The other thing is my expertise, my doctorate was in New Testament studies, and my focus was on the gospel traditions and the Book of Acts. So that's what I taught. For years, I taught New Testament studies. And in the course of doing that, I came to know and understand, based on what I studied, that Jesus' inclusivity was truly radical. And it was all-encompassing. No one was turned away who wanted to share his vision of life in the world. Even Pharisees, even Sadducees, even Romans in positions of power, anyone who really wanted to share his vision was welcome. And so in our community, in our mission statement, we say that we are committed to concretizing and embracing the radical inclusivity of Jesus in all that we do. And that's what we try to do.
I guess because I'm a feminist, but he doesn't seem so radical to me. but I can imagine maybe to some it seems pretty radical. Well, Jane, thank you. Thank you so very much for your time tonight. I think you've probably enlightened a lot of my listeners. I've enjoyed talking to you. And I thank you for being one of those uppity women reclaiming your power and being out there in the world just setting a wonderful example for Christians, for Catholics, for women, for men. Thank you. I can hear it's probably a struggle, and you're appreciated.
Well, thank you, Karen. I really appreciate the opportunity to dialogue with you. Thanks very much, and thank you for your work. It sounds like you have a wonderful radio show there.
Well, thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world. You've been listening to Jane Villa, a woman priest, or maybe one day we'll get her to call herself a woman priestess, truly a woman who is an inspiration, blazing a trail, or should I say restoring a trail or path that had been stolen from women everywhere. And I see my next guest is there on the switchboard. Let me welcome Vajra to the show. Hi, Vajra. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, my delight.
Well, let me start, Vajra, by just reading a bit of your bio for some of our listeners who may have not heard you the last time you were with us, because it's been quite some time now. Well, Vajra is an author, educator, modern-day priestess, and sacred performer. She teaches outside the codification of established traditions and doctrines. She designs and facilitates women's rituals since 1986, and she's integrated goddess knowledge and feminist spirituality with experiential body wisdom, which is the conscious awareness of subtle body energies. And in doing that, she forged Women Mysteries of the Ancient Future Sisterhood, a modern mystery school and priestess lineage based in the devotional moving meditation, the Tantric Dance of Feminine Power. She has featured Daughters of the Goddess, Studies of Healing, Identity, and Empowerment, an anthology of women's spiritual work in America. And her work has been the subject of scholarly papers presented at national conferences on religion. She holds ministerial credentials through the Temple of Diana in Madison, Wisconsin, and has an extensive background in dance studies and theater arts. She teaches with warmth, humor, and bedrock compassion. She resides in Sunny Valley, Oregon, with her husband Wolfgang and their various dangerous pets.
Well, goats welcome. Can be dangerous.
Well, Vajra, at the beginning of the show, I talked a little bit about what you and I were going to be talking about. Actually, I want to read to you what I said. I said, in the latter part of the show, Vajra, a sister who was once a mentor of mine many years ago, has just written From a Hidden Stream, The Natural Spiritual Authority of Woman, and we're going to get into it. What is this natural spiritual authority? Why does it matter? How does it relate to women's body? The indicators and evidence that women's spiritual authority is historical, examples of women asserting their natural spiritual authority today, and how we can use this to restore sanity and peace. I'm so glad this book is finally out and available now. We have a template to go by to encourage us. So I guess maybe let's start with explaining what you mean by natural spiritual authority, and is it different from regular authority?
Right, right. Huge difference. I do want to just say quickly that the book is, it's a short book. It's about 60 pages, very readable, very pithy, and it's condensed. It's an easy read, and yet it's a really dense read, too. And women have been telling me that it's really, really flipping their minds, really
flipping
their minds.
Well, we've got to make sure we tell them how to get it before we finish the conversation, too.
Right, right. This woman's natural spiritual authority is historical. It's a historical fact that women were the original shamans, the original spiritual leaders of society. It's all over the archaeological and anthropological evidence. And there's still some vestiges of it today in various cultures, like the Mosul culture in China. But to get to exactly what it is, it's really based in motherhood. And that this does not exclude a woman who does not have her own children, because I've not had children. But it's based in the in motherhood and also the collective consciousness of woman. When women get together, there's a certain collective awareness, a certain deeper mind that is based in the way women naturally function. It's based, you know, in the physiology of the female brain, how we function holistically from both sides of the brain, and how our spherical, holistic, sensual sense is connected in with our spiritual, with our spirituality. For women, in a very natural way, sexual experience is spiritual. It's connected to the heart. It's connected to bearing birth, nurturing children. You know, the consequences of our sexuality. So basically, the natural spiritual authority of woman is based in relationship and responsibility. When you look, I like to use an example from nature, from the lioness, and I know that you're connected to the lioness energy very much, Karen. The lioness, if you look at her, she's a supreme mother. You look at how she births her babies, and she's responsible to protect them. She nurtures them from her body, so she's responsible for their physical survival. She teaches them how to hunt, so eventually they can, you know, mature and take care of themselves. She protects them, how to hide, when to run, that sort of thing. She leads them to water. She leads them to food. So she is their authority, and they know it. They don't fight it. You know, she's their natural authority, and they must respect that and connect to her, because their survival depends upon it. So, and she doesn't do it, you know, in some ego-festive domination. She does it in service to life. She does it, mm-hmm, in service to them. You know, she's in relationship, mm-hmm, to them. So for, and I'll just make this bring it around a full circle here. So as women, we have an added dimension as human beings. When we have children, a woman has a child, we do all that the mother lioness does, but we also are responsible for the mental, emotional, and naturally the spiritual health of our child. We nurture and teach and guide. And that's a natural extension of our connection to the life that we've created. And that's how relationship and serving life and responsibility come in. It's inseparable from natural authority.
Well, you know, Vajra, I don't know if I've actually languaged it before, but listening to you talk, I'm thinking to myself, yes, of course, obviously we were talking about how this natural spiritual authority has been forgotten by women or stripped from women, but mm-hmm, I'm connecting the dots a little bit farther and thinking, and by virtue of that, it's almost as if the natural spiritual authority has been stripped from the planet. You know, we don't even, you know, our attitudes today about, you know, as if we can just grow, you know, on an unlimited way and things still be sustainable. I mean, all the different things that have us spiraling out of control and you know, seeming to be flushing us down the commode, you know, seems to be because that natural spiritual authority is lacking. You know, as if everybody's out there running amok with no lioness to sort of, you know, slap them into place and say,
slap them into place,
you know,
right.
Be right, be sane, you know.
That's a brilliant observation. Can I interject something here?
Sure,
because
yeah.
I don't want to lose it. You made me realize that you know, motherhood itself is embedded in a vaster motherhood, the motherhood of our planet to us. and to the cosmos. And in a very real way, what you just said, this planet has been stripped of that natural spiritual authority that it is. I mean, it can't really be taken away because nature will have its course with us. But if we're disrespectful and we ignore, you know, her natural leadership, her teaching us how to live, how to survive, to be in harmony and relationship with her, the earth itself, if we ignore that, we do it at our own peril, is what you've been saying. And the earth is really a natural spiritual authority to humanity.
And we've been very bad children. We have not been honoring her natural spiritual authority.
Right. And so relationship and responsibility and caring and nurturance, we get all our nurturance from her. There's nothing we have that doesn't come from the Earth Mother.
Well, and you know, we were just mentioning in the last show with Jane Via, woman priest, how a patriarchal religion, and we were specifically focused on Roman Catholic Church, but how we were talking about, you know, from the beginning, you know, these patriarchal religions just totally strip from women, you know, their value, their you know, their sense of self. You know, they're programmed to be second class, denigrated, and you know, and when we do that, you know, when we do that to women, and they don't have the empowerment within themselves. I mean, there's just so many personal, social, political, global ramifications when the woman is so oppressed.
It's astronomical. I mean, it is absolutely, it permeates everything.
And you realize that for how many years the brainwashing, we've sort of just accepted this as the norm. You know, maybe it's only now. You know, maybe this is part of this 2012 awareness, this paradigm shift we all talk about. You know, maybe seeing stuff like this and not just accepting what has gone on as natural is part of our awakening. You know, we see now, I think you said once everything's been turned on its head, you know, we take what is unnatural and we've been accepting it as natural.
And it's a complete reversal of the truth. Here's a reversal. We're dominating the earth and we can control nature. That's a reversal. We are affected and we are embedded in nature, and nature will control us ultimately if we disobey, you know, the common sense of taking care of our resources and living in harmony. Then the reversal that we live with in humanity, in patriarchy, is really based in a myth of male motherhood. And you look at the patriarchal religions and you'll see that, well, let's take the Bible, let's take Christianity. You have a male God in the garden, his garden of paradise. You have a male God creating a male human being, Adam. And then out of Adam, out of a man, he takes a rib and he creates a female. This is a complete reversal of what is real, of what reality is. Women give birth to men. The female creates the male. The male does not create the female, especially out of another male.
Right.
So, it's a complete reversal, and that myth of male motherhood was necessary because it is natural that the mother is the authority. It's a natural extension of birthing a child, you know, nurturing it from our bodies, guiding it, you know, teaching it, and then the spiritual teachings go right with that. It's a matrix.
So
not a
almost, I mean, and we might almost maybe even say that as the woman is stripped of her natural spiritual authority, those things which naturally are virtues or aspects of the feminine, you know, the compassion, the nurturing, the, you know, the intuition, the, you know, all of these different things that predominantly, you know, if we're going to, you know, not move beyond gender, you know, the things that are attributed to the feminine, those things get suppressed, which means they're lacking out there in the world. And, you know, and maybe that's why we have this sort of dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest world out there, you know, the callousness, the lack of compassion, and the idea that that's something to be proud of. I mean, it just seems crazy.
It is crazy. It's insane. And what, but I want to go back to this thing about what the feminine is.
Yeah.
Because you said it earlier, there's no one there to, like the lioness, slap them into place. The lioness will smack her cubs, good and hard, if they're getting out of line for their own good, right? She's teaching them.
Right.
Women need to come back into that. You call it the roar, the lioness roar. We need to come back to that aspect of the feminine, because the feminine is light, not light and fluffy and pretty. It is not divided into two halves. The life force is not divided into feminine and then masculine. The feminine encompasses the masculine, and it encompasses that very firm, assertive smack when you need it. And women need to come back to that. And Lema Bowie, who was who's founded the Mass Action for Peace in Liberia, which ended the Civil War. The women ended the Civil War in Liberia. That's a whole other story. It's in my book. You can get it online also if you look her up. But she calls it the demand. And she says, where we are failing is in making the demand. We must demand that we are treated with the respect we need, that we are deserving. We must demand that we are not denigrated any longer. We must demand our rights. We must demand respect. And that's where women need to stop being nice and demand. That's part of our natural spiritual story.
Well, I'm thinking this, Vajra, you know, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, my brain is starting to go to the political. You know, I'm thinking it's not just social. It's not just spiritual. When I think about the things we're tolerating as citizens that we're not demanding, you know, it's almost as if we have been bred into oppression. I mean, I know we're not slaves, obviously, you know, but it's almost as if we have, but women are 50% of the population. And if so many of them, you know, have this programming where their natural spiritual authority, their value, their empowerment has been stripped from their psyches, maybe no wonder there aren't more Americans, you know, marching in the street about the inequality and the injustice in our country.
Yes. Yes. And, actually our spiritual authority cannot be stripped from us. It's what is natural. This is what's important for women to understand.
Okay.
It's just under the surface. That's why I call it from a hidden stream. It's a hidden stream, but it's just under the surface. All you have to do is step into it. Just dig down a little bit and step into it. Our spiritual authority is natural. Therefore, it cannot be taken away from us. It can only be obscured. And that's why we are conditioned and fed all this conditioning, this male myth of male motherhood, all these policies, all this domination and coercion that is part of the authoritarian patriarchal paradigm. But it is right there in us. All we have to do is stand in it. Women need to know that. We don't have to reinvent something. We don't have to take anything back. We need to just recognize it within ourselves. That is the most radical thing that we can do. And I'm going to read what Bowie says about this, Lema Bowie. We need to start demanding, in the most radical sense, our respect, the respect of our daughters, sisters, and best friends. We also need to include a demand for our space, our time, and bring an end to everything that has contributed to violating us through policies, practices, and traditions. And you're talking about the political. It gets me very excited because the spiritual mandates the political. And
okay,
that's why, first of all, the collective power woman does not need guns, military structure, and coercion by threat of death or imprisonment. Woman as a collective has a power, a true power, but we need to assert it as a collective. That's kind of another subject. But let me give an example of what I mean by the spiritual mandates the political. Bowie said that they marched and protested to end the war in Liberia, they deliberately kept it from being political. They only spoke out for peace. They did not criticize politically or in any other way what she now calls the pathological Charles Taylor, who was the warlord. They didn't criticize him. They just kept asking for peace and protesting. So they stayed. What they did, in my view, is they stepped outside of the political box into the spiritual, which is bigger than the political box. It is bigger. It has more power, and it encompasses the political. Because here's what happened. They used spiritual practices. They chanted and sang and danced. That's how she, the first message she got, she was a Methodist, a Liberian Methodist. She got a message in a dream to gather the women together to chant and pray for peace. And she thought, well, how silly is that? She called it a silly dream. Okay? This shows you that natural spiritual authority can sound silly, but it's really the power of it's the where the real power is. So she did that, and the women did it, and they did that for 3 years. And that was a spiritual practice of shamans to chant and sing and pray. That's spiritual, and that kept them going. And I maintain that if they only tried a political protest without nourishing their souls and keeping their spirits going with the chanting and singing and praying, they never could have endured long enough to make this happen.
Well, and I wonder, too, Vajra, if one of the reasons they didn't get political was because how can anyone fight the idea of peace? But politics, there's always different ideologies, and if they had maybe, you know, taken up one, you know what I'm saying? It would have given people something to fight against. But how do you fight against wanting peace?
Exactly. And how do you fight against – this other thing is that motherhood is by its very essence – inclusive. Remember that I did hear the tail part of your interview with the Catholic woman priest, that Jesus was radically inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And motherhood is inclusive. So it doesn't divide. And it's something that we can all rally around. Motherhood, taking care of our children, taking care of the next generation, loving
right.
and nurturing. Yeah. So
So how can, well, I mean, if you look at it on the political scene, you know, when you have the conservatives on the right saying, you know, let's destroy the social safety net, let's not fund education, well, that, you know, that's when women should rise up in their natural spiritual authority and say, wait a minute, this is crazy. You know, we're not taking care of, you know, our people, our children. Is that,
yes.
Am I understanding this right?
Yes. Well, yes.
Okay.
I mean, absolutely. And there's a woman that's going even further than that. She's saying, well, I don't know if it's even further, but I totally agree that the mother instinct is to say, that's wrong. We need to take care of our children. However, maybe there's also something outside the box of looking for government to do it. You know, expecting laws, expecting the government, it has its place, but it's not the only place that things happen.
Right. Because we need it to happen in our churches, we need it to happen in our communities, we need it to happen in corporate America. You know, it just can't happen in government. It has to be a paradigm shift.
Totally. Now, there's a woman in Israel named Ada Aroni who has an idea. I don't know how far along she's gotten on it. She wants to create a world TV satellite for the culture of peace to see everything through the eyes of mothers on both sides of conflicts, on the Israeli and the Palestinian side, on the this side or the that side, you know, on the Catholic or the Protestant, but to really see, to get daily, can you imagine, Karen, can you imagine if we had daily news that was about wars and conflicts that was presented to us from the eyes of mothers, of women?
I suspect what would happen is we would suddenly see how alike we are rather than how different we are, and all of the conflict would just sort of dissolve. You know,
where
would the military-industrial complex be then?
Well, exactly, and the insanity. We would see the insanity of it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Julia Ward Howe in her original Mother's Day proclamation, she's also in my book, that she said, you know, the hearts of our women in our country will be too tender to the women in the other countries to have our children go over and kill theirs.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it just reduces it to a totally different level when you're talking about mothers and children, you know, rather than these faceless soldiers. I totally get it. Well, but you're saying now it goes beyond just this idea of our natural spiritual authority. You say it has something to do with our physical body.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that is the basis. that as it has played out historically, as well as, you know, in reality today, is that there's three aspects I see of woman's body that is the basis for our natural spiritual authority. One is the womb, the womb as physical creator. That's obvious. We birth children. Okay. Why shouldn't we be their spiritual authority as well as their physical authority by giving them birth and nurturing them? Secondly, the womb is a dreaming organ. It's a visioning organ. It is a spiritual creator or a spiritual portal. And that has played out historically and still today, if women will tap into it, through our menses, through our menstrual cycle, which is a natural shamanic descent every month into a death cycle. You know, the egg has died, it hasn't been fertilized, and so we bleed it out, and then we start again fresh as the virgin and build that lining back up in the uterus, and then we, you know, potentially be the mother, and if that we don't become a mother, become a crone, and we go through that death cycle again and bleed out. There's your triple goddess right there. But the women used to get together in moon lodges in tribal societies and bleed at the same time and come together for vision for the people, formally, to create, to get guidance, spiritual wisdom. Because women, when we're bleeding, we're much more psychically sensitive, and that's what PMS is all about. It's because women aren't slowing down and dreaming enough and going internally to get that, because the veil is thin between the world, you might say, between life and death, between the other dimensions, other frequencies where we can get spiritual knowledge, you know. So, you know, you are very open and very psychic, and you need more dream time, actually. And you can dream better when you're more creative when you're bleeding. There's a whole surge of hormones and things that goes on. And women use that consciously to bring through vision for the people, to be spiritual guides. And then thirdly, just the whole nature of woman's body, which I spoke about a little bit earlier, of our holistic sensual aliveness and how our right brain and left brain are connected by a larger corpus callosum, nerve bundles. We're more holistic in our brain functions. And we have a natural connection of the heart to our sensual and sexual experiences. Now, that can be also distorted, but, you know, and conditioned out, but it's more natural to women. So this holistic, we're a holistic calibrator of reality as our body is a totality.
Okay.
And all of that feeds into being able to guide, not just protect and teach in a general way, but to guide humanity spiritually.
Right,
does that make
right.
sense?
No, it does. And I'm thinking there's also something about the rods and the cones in our eyes. And I always get the rods and the cones mixed up, but men have one and women have another. And the one that men have makes them sort of have tunnel vision. But the other one women have, and it sort of gives them a broader big picture look. So they tend to, something about the rods and the cones. Yeah, so women think about how their decisions are going to affect people around them, where men tend to be a little bit more self-centered. So that sort of plays into it, too. So it even goes beyond the womb.
It goes way beyond the womb. It goes into the cellular level. It goes into all kinds of other physiological things. You're absolutely right. Interestingly, I do know that the fibers in the eyes are almost identical to the fibers in the womb.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the third eye, which, you know, in esoteric metaphysics, et cetera, the third eye, the inner vision, which is the pineal gland, which is in the center of the brain, at the level of the forehead, therefore the third eye, is often called the eye of the womb.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, the pineal gland translates chemical information in the body, and particularly sexual information, and particularly light, moonlight, sunlight, into inner pictures or inner pictures, inner vision. And there you have women in their moon lodge, you know, with the eye of the womb. It's a portal.
You know, I'm, you know, forgive me for saying I'm so angry, but I am angry. I'm angry that we have lost so much, you know, that as women we can't still have these moon lodges and we can't realize or so many women, you know, aren't able to realize their full potential. Because, you know, it's not just hurting the individual woman. I mean, it's hurting society. It's hurting the world. And, I mean, I hate to say it, but for me, it always goes back to the scourge of patriarchal religion. You know, I mean, the damage it has done the world. And I know religion has done good things, but at least from my perspective in this moment, you know, the bad, you know, the war.
Well, whatever good it has done because of nurturing and love and a mother mind kind of mentality, a mothering.
Yeah, or they may want to say a Jesus mind, you know, however, whatever label they want to put on it, because I see Jesus as sort of the mother mind.
Yes, yes. I had a personal relationship with Jesus. I had a miraculous experience with him when I was 19. I've never denied it. He is a prophet, an avatar, whatever you want to call him, but truly a spiritual being that is still operating in the world today, I believe.
Well, did you want to elaborate on that a bit more?
Well, I think he was the true son of the goddess. He was
okay.
A true son of the goddess, and if you look at the Bible, he was supported by women. An entourage
right.
of women followed him around, and they were the purse strings that helped him support his mission. Joanna, Salome, the three Marys, you know, they were all there in the Bible.
Right.
And so his teachings are really based in mother mind, which is actually a phrase that a Zulu healer uses, credo mutua. And mother mind is how men can participate in this motherhood of woman, which is natural to woman. But mother mind, it just means that you are feeling what's happening in the world. You feel what's happening, and you care.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. You know, we're focused so much on the natural spiritual authority of women. How do men fit into the equation?
Just that way. If men, you know, men know it. They really do know that women have a power that they do not have. And it has to do with being able to birth. It has to do with, you know, the Shakti, the life force that is in us because we are life givers and life bearers. Men know it. And, you know, they either are going to denigrate it and try to control it out of their fear, or they need to just tolerate the terror of it with reverence.
That's priceless. I love that.
Well, you know, my husband Wolfgang, who totally sees woman for who she is. That's why I'm married to him. He says, you know, that a man, when he sees a beautiful woman, his very first instinct is feeling is awe, which is very close to fear. And his next instinct is either going to be surrender to that awe, that fear, surrender to it, or try to control it and denigrate it.
Mm-hmm. That makes
sense.
And
that's so true.
Yeah, he's awfully insightful, that guy of yours.
He is. He really is.
So, I
wanted to go back to this thing, though, that women can't have moon lodges. Yes, we can. And you know that we can. We need to create them. We need to consciously seek each other out and create that for each other. Because this whole thing about you know, the natural spiritual authority of woman and leading humanity and being the creators of humanity that we are and the leaders of humanity is a collective endeavor. And we need each other, and we've been dismembered from each other. And you see it in the mythology. You see the dismemberment of the goddess herself. You see it in the Sumerian myth of Gilgamesh, where Marduk cuts his mother in half and makes heaven and earth out of her, Tiamat, out of Tiamat, his mother. Well, she already existed. She already created heaven and earth. But he takes her and cuts her in half and makes his own new creation, male-dominated creation. It's in all the mythology where the goddess is dismembered. She's cut up into pieces, or she's destroyed, or she's slain. And this is what's happened to women. We've been separated. We've been dismembered from our collective consciousness, separated out into nuclear families, disempowered that way. And we need to come together and recreate that synergy of our collective wisdom. So,
well, you know, call it my lioness sacred roar, you know, but I just feel like, you know, you and I, we're so lucky because, you know, we live this, we eat this, we sleep it, you know, we breathe
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine what my life would have been like not knowing this. I feel like I would have just been an empty shell. But I think about the woman in Tallahassee, You know what I'm saying? Or, you know, somewhere in red state Mississippi or West Virginia where, you know, it's just this, you know, sort of, you know, right-wing, authoritarian, subservient woman thing constantly depriving her of her natural spiritual authority. And I just feel like, you know, we so need to have, you know, women's colleges helping us, you know, remember this, to just help us restore ourselves. And I know I'm being an idealist, you know, but it's almost as if that's really what we need to awaken women everywhere. I mean, it's a huge undertaking.
It's a huge undertaking. It is. And that's why we need each other. So, you know, every one of us right now can just think of a woman in our life who maybe doesn't have this understanding. Do we have it? Let's extend ourselves to her. Let's call her into a circle. Let's have a reading group together and read some of the books that women have written. Mine, for instance, yours, for instance. Start to support each other and get that sense of strength, revive that sense of strength. And if you look, you know, women just stop and look. If you look at most of the churches, you know, the patriarchal churches, who does the cleaning? Who does the committee work? Who does the supporting? Who does the all of this? The women do it. And the patriarchal religions are using the Shakti, the life force of woman, to run the patriarchal paradigm. If we withdraw that and put it instead in service to life, in whatever little way comes across in our own individual life, and in whatever way we can connect with other women to support them, and whatever way we can connect with men to support them in truly honoring and respecting women and the earth and children, then we are stepping into our natural authority. And we are withdrawing our Shakti, our life force, our power, our support from the patriarchal paradigm. It can't exist without our support, without Shakti.
Well, and also, too, you're saying withdraw the Shakti, but I'm also thinking, you know, that they're, you know, you're saying that they're using that to support their institution. But, you know, but thinking of it even in another way, they are using what comes natural to us against us. And this is what I mean by that. For, you know, so we naturally think big picture, how what we do is going to affect the community, our family, whatever. So maybe that stops that woman from, you know, pulling her support from the church on the corner because, you know, it's going to have social implication. It's going to have implications in the family. So she sacrifices herself in order, and by doing so, it's almost as if she helps to perpetuate the patriarchy. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. You painted it beautifully. And it's tough. And I think the way, the beginning point for a woman is to get the bigger picture that you've been painting and I've been painting, which is what's happening to the whole planet, what's happening to all of humanity. As a human family, we've got to think even bigger than our own church, bigger than our own family, and that will naturally encompass and create benefit for our own family, for our own church, or whatever it is, our own community. But we've got to break this conditioning of the male myth of motherhood, myth of male motherhood, of the natural, as if male spiritual authority is natural. It is not. It is unnatural. And you know, get my book. I'm not trying to just peddle my book because it's my book. I want women, they can digest this, they can get it. It's a primer for the future of humanity. They can get it. We need to break the false ideas.
Well, like you said, it's only like 65 pages. I mean, so it's really concise. It's not like you have to take a course or you have to go buy 20 books. You know, you kind of have it really just wrapped up on, you know, in a nice little package with a bow on it here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think anybody could just pick it up and in an hour read it, you know?
And there's examples in it of women who've been in their natural spiritual authority that is completely outside of religion. You know, it doesn't have to operate within a religion. There are women from the past, from Hildegard of Bingen, from way back in the Middle Ages, other women that... So if you don't have to change your religion to step into your natural spiritual authority.
Now, you were going to talk about some of the indicators and evidence that women's spiritual authority is historical. Weren't there other examples of this, like, you know, Amici and one of the grandmothers? And
oh, yes, yes, yes. Beautiful examples. Grandmother Rebonon of the 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, she's from Gabon, Africa, and she talks about how the president of Gabon still listens to the women. And once a year, for about a month, the women, a large group of women go out into the forest and counsel there together and stay there together. It's like a month-long moon lodge, okay? And they get vision for the people, and they come back, and they talk to the president about what they've received. And this is a collective venture. He's not listening just to one woman, not like one woman counselor. He's listening to the collective wisdom of these women. And he follows their counsel. And they've managed to stay out of war while the countries around them are warring. So that's the real, tangible relevance of women standing in their natural spiritual authority. And the other example, Amici, she talks about the ancient Sanskrit word. Amici is the hugging saint of India. Most people have heard about her. She hugs people by the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient Sanskrit word for wife is literally means she who leads her husband on the path of righteousness.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a concept
Wait,
for a wife,
figured
huh?
Wife meant chattel in patriarchal terms.
Now, I want to read for you from page 42 in my book where Max Dashew, who has done 40 years of research and collections of photographs and slides about the suppressed histories of women, she's done a marvelous work. Just to see in her article, Priestesses, Power, and Politics, she gives us a glimpse into how globally pervasive the usurpation of female spiritual authority has been, which conversely gives us a sense of how extensive women's spiritual authority once was. She says, a male takeover of women's rights and mysteries is described in oral histories from Australia, Melanesia, the Amazon Basin, Tierra del Fuego, Kenya, Sierra Leone, and elsewhere. Encroachments on the sphere of priestesses are also attested in the pagan Mediterranean. The priests of Apollo took control of oracular shrines at Delphi and Didyma, interpreting the women's ecstatic utterances and forbidding women the right to consult the Pythias, who were the priestesses. Male Aerophants also gradually consolidated their control over the mysteries of Eleusis, where legal records show that the Melissai priestesses contested masculine trespasses on their traditional rites in the 4th century. And one last sentence. And another ancient oral history says that Amazon queens founded the great temple of Artemis at Ephesus. Women were later forbidden to enter into its holy of holies, according to the Roman era writer Artemidorus. So it just gives you an example of how global woman's spiritual authority was and the global takeover. And so women can really take heart, Karen. You know, we can take heart that it's there in the DNA, it's there in the genetics, it's there in the collective memory of men and women. It's just hidden. It's a hidden stream. It's just right below the surface. It's not far away.
Well, you were going to tell us what the ultimate symbol and embodiment of spiritual authority is. I don't think you've told us yet.
No, and it might be obvious by now. You see it in the Catholic Church, of all places, right? You see it. It's the mother and the child. It's the Madonna. And the Madonna is, again, it's global. You see Madonnas in Egypt. You see them in China. You see, you know, of course, we see it in the Western, you know, tradition of Mary and Jesus, Isis and Horus. And there's no greater, it's the very essence of natural spiritual authority, the responsibility and the power and the relationship all together, the power. Woman has power to create life, and she has the responsibility to protect it and nurture it and guide it spiritually. And that is all in the mother, the icon of the mother and the child, the holy child.
Well, and you, I know we've sort of been, you know, maybe touching on this, you know, delicately, but did you, you know, did you want to sort of hone in or sort of punctuate why you think that this is, you know, this natural spiritual authority of woman can really be a way for us to restore not just peace to the world, but, you know, sanity among peoples?
I don't think there's anything else that can do it. Especially when you consider that love, mother love, there's no greater love than mother love, and that's men participate in that just as much as a woman if he will let himself. We cannot solve the problems with more authoritarianism, with coercion. We need to reassert the sanity of motherhood.
And value and that, it. I think it's been really sort of taken for granted.
Well, get this. At the end of my book, I talk about Judy Chicago, the marvelous feminist artist. Back in the 70s, she wanted to do an art piece about birthing process. So she went to the library to look for some pictures of birthing, and she couldn't find any, hardly any. And she goes, wait a minute, what is this? This is the source of life. This is the source of creation, and there's no pictures. And birth itself has been completely desacralized. And what could be more sacred than giving birth, creating new life? Yeah. But you don't find it.
We talked about in the other interview, was this man's vagina envy, you know, this you know, turning everything on its head, making it unnatural. You know how, you know, men talk about penis envy, but it's almost as if, you know, they so wanted what they, you know, what they didn't have naturally that, as you said before, you know, it became, you know, they demonized it or denigrated it. You know, if they couldn't be in awe of it, like Wolfgang said, you know, if they would go in the other direction.
Yeah, and there's your reversal right there. It's not penis envy. It's vagina envy. Absolutely.
Well, Basha, we're about out of time here. You know, has there been anything we haven't talked about, you know, any points you definitely want to, you know, maybe punctuate before we say goodnight and we tell folks how to get your wonderful book?
I would like to say that, again, this stream, this constant flow of woman's power and woman's natural spiritual authority, it's a hidden stream. But it's not far. It's just beneath the surface. And I really want to encourage women to just feel into themselves. Take some time, sit alone, and feel into this. Feel into what happens to you when you think of a mother God, a mother, a great mother who would care for you and nurture you and guide you. What happens? Well, that is your own internal power to guide and create and lead humanity. I don't want any woman to think she doesn't have it in her. She has it in her. Trust that. Trust yourself. Trust your gut feeling. Trust your heart.
Okay. Thank you for that, Basha. And how do we find your book?
My book is available at my website, which is pretty easy to remember, greatgoddess.org.
There you go, greatgoddess.org. Mm-hmm. And if for any reason, listeners, you don't have a pen and paper, you can always contact me, and I'll certainly put you in touch with Vajra. Well, Vajra, thank you so very much for being on the show. You're always a welcome guest here, and, you know, the work you're doing in the world is so important. Thank you, too. You and Jane were just wonderful bookends tonight, both uppity women, telling our female sisters out there to go out there and claim, you know, claim their empowerment, claim their authority, claim their leadership. And you know what? That's what we all have to do.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's been an absolute joy. And thank you for your show. And everybody, support the show. Support the show.
Thank you so much. I actually have some donations coming in.
Good. It's a worthy cause.
All right. Thank you, Vajra, and good night. Have a happy new year.
Thank you. You too.
Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in tonight. I hope you've enjoyed our two wonderful guests. And I'd like to close the show tonight with a beautiful prayer that I actually got from her church in San Francisco. Some of you may have heard me talk about her church. They are a feminist church in San Francisco. I think they're Lutheran, and they have a wonderful feminist conference at the in the fall of every year, and they make wonderful goddess rosaries. If you want one of them, you can go to herchurch.org. They're tailor-made for you, depending on you know, what stones you'd like in the rosary. They're a very small version of a regular rosary, and at the end, instead of Jesus on the cross, there's some sort of a goddess symbol, or there are different things you can choose from. But anyway, that's what I would like to do tonight, is honor Pastor Reverend Stacy Bourne over there. She's doing a wonderful job at her church, and encourage you to go look at that website, maybe check out their rosaries. What I learned from them when I actually co-ministered a service with her one time when they asked me to be a visiting reverend was this wonderful prayer. And I feel like it so fits after what Vajra has been saying about our natural spiritual authority. The symbol of that is the mother. And that's what who this prayer is to. So let's just take a quick minute here to take a deep breath and sort of shift our focus, you know, out of this left brain listening and maybe into more of a right brain feeling, you know, where we go to connect with our divine source, with our great mother. Take a deep breath with me. And this is the prayer that they use when they say the Goddess Rosary. Our Mother who is within us, we celebrate your many names. Your wisdom come, your will be done, unfolding from the depths within us. Each day you give us all that we need. You remind us of our limits and we let go. You support us in our power and we act with courage. For you are the dwelling place within us, the empowerment around us, and the celebration among us, now and forever. Amen. Ashi Jaima. Hallelujah. Hail, Goddess full of grace, blessed are you and blessed are the fruits of your womb, for you are the mother of us all. Hear us now and in all our dreams and needs. Heal us now in all our dreams and needs. O blessed be, O blessed be. And that's adapted from Carol Crist. Well, listeners, I hope you've been encouraged tonight. I hope you've been inspired to go out there and find your voice and to use your sacred roar, not just for you or your family, but for Goddess and your sisters around the world. I hope you'll tune in with us next week. We have a fella coming on the show, Thaddeus Russell, and he's going to talk to us about some historical women of ancient times, contemporary times, that you know, sort of help shape the world in which we live. And we're also going to have Art Noble. So next week we're going to be talking to two guys who get it. So thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Thanks to those of you who have been able to send us donations to keep us on the air. I hope more of you might be able to do that. And it is my pleasure to host this show. It is my pleasure. This is my guilty pleasure. Thank you so very much for tuning in. Thank you for listening. And thank Goddess for all the boons that come my way. Please remember reciprocity. Remember to always, always, always be in gratitude to the Great Mother who provides everything we need. Good night, listeners.